Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we grapple with in this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Tuesday, Tyler. How are you today?
I am well, thank you. I have been very busy, but I was able to take a little bit of work-life balance this morning and get some workout in and get some of my Bravo TV watching in, so I'm all caught up.
Isn't that amazing that getting a little bit of something that makes us feel like ourselves makes the rest of the day easy? It doesn't have to be a long time.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been really working on this about a little bit each day. One personal thing for me and then one mental, physical health thing for me.
That's terrific. And it's great, too, because I think when we generally think about life balance, life work balance, and how do we fit things in, that our assumption is, well, if I can't put aside a whole day for myself, then I'm not going to bother. Or if I don't have 4 hours, then, you know, I don't have enough time. But it really can be done in these short increments. I don't know if you've been reading, but there's this kind of movement in the exercise world of doing 2-minute in-place exercises in your workstation, or like going up the stairs for 2 minutes, that we really can. We can bring that balance in short bursts if necessary. I mean, it's nice to have a whole day, but it's good to kind of sneak it in. And then, I mean, you just look more glowy today than usual.
Oh,
so
thank
you. Yeah, I need something.
Well, I'll start working out right now. Well, what's on your mind today?
all right, so I was feeling very organized. I had this show in the works a couple weeks ago. I really was musing on this whole world of marriage that I am a participant in. And I kind of had this, you know, after all the rains and the springtime flowers and all the new growth and the possibilities and the hope and the love that's in the air, all the young love that's in the air, you know, I started thinking about my own life and my own marriage and how challenging it is when you're married to kind of ride those seasons of a marriage. Because a marriage quite often is like the seasons of the year, where you go through periods of time that are kind of dark and dreary and a long winter, and you might have a fall where things are just kind of neutral and crisp. And, you know, you hopefully have that summer where things are just comfortable and warm and you enjoy being there. But the part of marriage that sometimes becomes elusive is that springtime. Time part of marriage, that part where everything seems new and you feel rejuvenated about your relationship and you feel excited about each other. And I think because I work on a college campus, and when spring has sprung and the campus comes alive, I start thinking, hey, it doesn't feel like it was that long ago that I was here at 19 with my husband, now my boyfriend, and eating Gus's sandwiches and, you know, kind of falling in love. And so I think maybe because I work in the place that I fell in love 38 years ago, I am more, I don't know, connected to this sense of, hey, Where is that springtime in my marriage? Where is that springtime in my relationship? And what are we doing or not doing to kind of make that happen? And along the lines with that, the common cultural story is that marriages do just kind of wane and fall into this comfortable routine and that kind of summertime of ease and, you know, or the fall where things are just kind of rolling along, moving towards the winter. But that's a cultural story, because if you look at research studying long-term married couples, those, and a third of all long-term married couples report being blissfully happy. Another third report being really satisfied. And really only a third of those who've been married for a long time report being very unhappy. So I'm going to stay with the two-thirds and even the third that say they're blissfully happy. And they talk about how they retain that sense of romantic love for each other, that passion remains. And we know just biologically that when you are intimate with someone and you release those hormones and the oxytocin, the vasopressin, you know, that is all it takes to kind of retain that energy and excitement in the relationship. So that's where I was. That's what I was thinking about coming into today's show. But then last night I had a dream. And I know that that's the worst thing. People hate that beginning of any conversation. Like, oh, let me tell you about the dream I had last night. But I'm going to be that person. And I'm going to tell you about the dream I had last night. Just the part that stuck out, because I'm not a big follower of my dreams. But sometimes something's so big in your face that you have to pay attention. So a lot of things are happening, but in this moment of my dream, there is my young nephew, and he's a strapping young 14-year-old boy, tall, you know, very athletic, very bright, quick-witted, you know, kind of, he's just growing into himself, all arms and legs, akimbo, and, you know, kind of finding his way. But I've, you know, in the dream, there he is, he's sitting on a couch with his arms folded, looking at me with his hat sideways, and, you know, just giving me a hard time like he does, because he's 14 now, so he's kind of strapped on that adolescent, I'm too cool to really care about you attitude. And, you know, we have a good relationship, and I kind of give him his space. But what was interesting is I got up to leave the conversation. This is all in my dream. This is a dream scenario. I got up to leave the conversation. I said something to him, and he stood up before I could stand up, and he collapsed in my arms. And he's a big boy, but he just collapsed in my arms with his head on my chest and started sobbing and sobbing. And I just patted his back and held him. And then the dream went on in other weird directions. But I woke up this morning, and that image was so strong in my head. And I thought, something is trying to get to the forefront of my psyche. And it has to be related to the news of the weekend and what's going on in the community. You know, the blackface incident with the Lambda Chi fraternity on campus. When I was on campus yesterday, all of my classes, the students wanted to talk about it and were feeling heartsick about it. I have so many feelings about what's happening on campus and with the fraternities and with the young men that are in the fraternities. And so I had to kind of rethink today's show a bit. And I wanted, and I will get there. If you hang with me, I'll get there. But I want to weave in that this toxic masculinity that has overtaken our young boys, our young men, this cultural force that drives the feeling and the emotion and the tenderness out of our young boys and forces them into this place where they are hyper-masculine, doing ridiculous things, behaving badly, behaving abhorrently, that I don't see that as being their natural state, that we've come to accept it, that this is how boys, fraternity boys, young men behave. But that dream was a reminder that they're really still feeling young men and young boys, and at some point in their life, that is ripped out of them and they are forced into this place. And how this forced entrance into this world of toxic masculinity and hypermasculinity and bad behavior carries on in their life out in the world past their college experience or their young, you know, 20s experience, whatever that is, and then into their relationships and into their marriages. And things are changing culturally all around us. Women are growing and changing and becoming empowered and strong, and they have high expectations for their partners they're going to choose. And unless we can help lift up these young men, unless we can change the culture that is forcing them to go down a path that eliminates much of their inherent beauty, then I worry about the future of marriage. And so my musings of marriage will take this full circle. So that's where we're going to go today. I want to talk about the incident, and let's start with that, because I know you've been so busy. You and I ran into each other on the street on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
So you're firsthand know, for the people that aren't aware of what happened, let's tell them why we're concerned about Lambda Chi and Cal Poly today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I did. I ran into you on the street right in the middle of trying to track down that story. And as I reported for KCBX News, basically I was sent a photo Sunday that showed a fraternity member in what appeared to be blackface. It very much was blackface. And I spoke with a fraternity, and first they didn't want to speak to me, and then they definitely opened up and said, and sent out a release later and said, you know, this was a huge misunderstanding, that they were wearing different colors, that things got, people were painting their bodies, and this was just a mistake, and so they exercised bad judgment. And that was the initial story. And then that night I was sent a photo of this same fraternity, and they were wearing stereotypical gang wear, think sagging pants and sleeveless undershirts, plaid shirts, headbands, just very, very stereotypical wear, and it very much changed the story that this was an accident, that they were on colors, that this was some sort of brotherhood bonding exercise, and in fact, they were portraying perhaps different races and ethnicities, and changed the story. And so as a result, they have not issued a response to this. They have been, as of yesterday, interim suspension from the dean of students and from their own international headquarters of the fraternity. And then last night I also went to an emergency town hall on campus that was put on by the Black Student Union that was, to say the least, very moving. Just hundreds and hundreds of students literally spilling out of this auditorium. People couldn't even get in. Talking, and preference was given to people of color and to the Black student population to speak their mind. And they had a lot to say, and they're angry, and they're upset, and this joins the national conversation that we're having about race right now, and they want to see something done by the fraternity. And I'll have more about this later this afternoon during All Things Considered.
I know, you have been busy.
Yes.
You have been busy. And like all stories and all events and all things that are happening culturally in our society, not just on campus at Cal Poly, because this is happening all over the country, but we'll focus on what's happening here today. It's even when we address this incident or this issue or the culture or atmosphere on campus, we can't overlook the fact that our college campuses are just a microcosm or a small example of what's happening in the greater culture. You know, the things that happen on campuses and college campuses and high school campuses really reflect the attitude and the behavior of the adults who are supposed to be modeling the way we are to behave in the greater culture. And so I have, you know, two thoughts on it. One is, maybe this is the moment where things come from the bottom up. I talk a lot about that rarely has any social change ever come from the top down. It's always come from the bottom up, that the people have come together and said, enough. And we see it with Parkland students coming together, and now we see the students coming together on, you know, different. This isn't the first racial issue we've had or had to look at. And so maybe that bubbling up will be the thing that changes the greater cultural story. And whether or not it does in this moment, what I think the greater culture needs to understand, these kids are coming out of these schools. They're coming into society, and they're coming into society educated, aware, alive, and ready for things to change. And so there is going to be monumental revolutionary change. And I hope that we are educating and catching enough of these young people so that the change doesn't leave a whole segment of this population behind. Because I started off saying, I worry for the fraternities. I know that that's probably the worst, most unpopular thing to say right now, but I worry for these boys who've gone into these organizations, most of them feeling like this was a place where they would make relationships and do good acts and good deeds and create. But the message they're getting and the experience they're having is not preparing them for the changing world that they're going to meet when they get out of school.
Absolutely. If you don't mind me just adding real quick that I spoke with a gentleman yesterday when I went on campus to get student reactions. And this was a first year, and his name was Liam Graham. And he said, you know, that he first of all said you couldn't believe that these kids didn't exercise better judgment. And then said, I'm in a fraternity too, and this is impacting my experience because we don't have a good reputation on campus already. And this already ruins the thing. And I said, why did you join a fraternity in the first place? And he said, you know, for a good group of friends that I can count on and mm-hmm. depend on.
Mm-hmm. And so that's where I want to pick this up today. I want to talk about, and because I'm not a man, I'm not going to pretend that I can speak on masculinity with any true depth and purpose, but I have you, Tyler, and I've dragged my husband in here today as my wingman because I want to talk about how young men are learning about masculinity and what it is to be a man in our culture and how that is changed for them when they get into this fraternity system that they hope is going to actually be a positive for them. So we're going to swing that direction. We're going to bring it around to my musings on marriage because, you know, 90% of our happiness in our life will be determined by the quality of our relationships. 90% of our misery and 90% of our happiness is determined by the quality of those intimate relationships that we have. And if we have a whole segment of our population that is incapable of really joining and having deep, intimate relationships because we have pledged and hazed the feelings out of them, then that's going to hurt marriage and intimacy and families long term. So I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can be part of the conversation by calling 805-781-3875. You can also reach me on my Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or by email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. Tyler is great about getting them up quickly, so you can listen to the shows. You can also podcast by looking into Apple Podcasts or NPR One for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. We'll be back to open up the line and take your calls. Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And that was the first dance song my husband and I danced to when we got married multiple 30s ago. All right. So thanks for coming in today. And I know that speaking on the air is not your favorite place to be, but I'm hoping that you can kind of add into the conversation where you feel fit when it comes to talking about masculinity or your experience as a man in culture and how you learned to behave the way you do. Okay. You're a Cal Poly graduate.
Yes.
You were not in a fraternity.
No.
And you graduated from college in 1980.
1981.
Mm-hmm. So right there, kind of in the heart of the feminist movement, right at the peak of it. So things were changing culturally. You probably weren't aware of that at the time.
No, I was just thinking that.
Oh, you were?
I was somewhat unaware of, you know, maybe the feminist movement.
Right. And that, but things were changing socially at that time. Mm-hmm. And so I think in some ways there was a freedom, and maybe it was the unique group of people that we associated with, but all of the men that I met, your friends in college and your friends from before, were pretty feeling guys, like weren't the manly men. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to say that without sounding insulting, but not that stereotypical guy. Mm-hmm. And so part of me wonders, like, how did we get from where we were when you and I started dating in 1980, you know, and kind of this whole flowering of possibility in relationships, and when we were married and our friends got married, and how quickly you and your guy friends got into the role of being nurturers and taking care of our daughters and learning to braid hair, like doing all these kind of non-traditional men things. You all just did this. It felt like, it felt natural.
Mm-hmm, it did.
And it wasn't the way our fathers were.
No. But part of it was my upbringing, find a way to be of use.
Right.
Always. So, always be helpful, always pitch in.
It's the Boy Scout in you.
Yeah, but I wasn't, you know, a man like men were in the 40s, 50s, and 60s,
right.
Becoming a man in the late 70s. You know, my older brothers, so to speak, that kind
about
of were pioneered
forefathers.
The social revolution of the 60s, maybe 10 years older than me, you know,
yeah.
kind of blazed the trail. And so there was no way I was not going to be a part of, you know, a more active part of our marriage and our children's upbringing and changing diapers and you know, that kind of thing. It was just a desire to be part of that, too.
And it wasn't as if you and I ever sat and talked about it, either. We never said, hey, you better pitch in, or this is, you know, both of us. And we never really had a conversation about our gender roles or our marriage roles. We just kind of fell into it pretty naturally.
But we also had some very traditional male-female roles
we
in
did.
Our marriage.
We have.
I was the breadwinner. You were the full-time at-home mom, you know.
So we did. Yeah, we did fall into that category. But I guess the reason, the thing that I'm grappling with today is, there was so much promise. It never occurred to us that it would be any other way. And our friends carried on this way. But here we are in 2018. And instead of seeing this full egalitarian relationships unfolding, we see a certain small segment of our population, those that are college educated, who get married at an older age, who, you know, are more free thinking and open minded with their life experiences, who are creating those egalitarian, equal roles, men staying at home with their children, women being the primary breadwinner. But it's a really small segment of our population. It's not, this is not something that took off in the 80s and spread across the country. I mean, if you look at marriages and relationships still across the country, for the bulk of people, they're very traditional in their roles, and that men are still considered the head of the household and the main, you know, taskmaster. And
I worked in a really conservative industry and somewhat white male dominated, but my peers, the other engineers, as they had young families, were also involved as I was. Even if they were very, you know, politically conservative, their marriage was more of a partnership when it came to parenting and
relationally connected.
Yeah, and just,
but was
know,
that
awareness.
True with the technicians, though? Because you're talking, again, about that small segment
right.
of college-educated.
That's true. Maybe some of the touch labor guys that weren't, and men and women that weren't, especially men, that weren't college-educated, probably still more traditional even to this day.
So I guess that's part of it, is how did we stall out when it came to male and female relationships moving forward? And then jumping forward to today and the conversation about what's going on campus and, you know, the fraternity and the young men behaving badly. And the young student that Tyler was talking to said, I'm a part of a fraternity and this isn't what I wanted to be a part of. You know, as an instructor on campus, I have had an incredibly positive experience with the fraternity members that have been in my classes that I have interacted with over the last decade. And I have enjoyed every one of them, and I found them to be polite and honest and involved in their community and involved in their relationships. And of course, I get probably a special group of the fraternity members because I teach family psychology and relationship skills. And so, of course, it attracts the young men that already want to be a part of that. But that's been my experience. And so I'm always so disheartened when something negative happens, when this continued toxic masculinity rears its head and hurts not just the people that they're demeaning, right, or the people that they're insulting, their racist actions, you know, their...
So, you know, that might be a question for someone that's smarter on anthropology and social science, you know, who might be able to tell you. But it seems like a lot of things, you know, it isn't all just a smooth, steady, linear increase in awareness and progress.
True.
And so maybe there's a lot of progress for a while there, and then we're kind of at a plateau, and maybe even a little bit of a, you know, falling back, you know, losing ground a little bit. And you know, some of that progress was in the 60s, a very revolutionary time and very tumultuous.
I know, but I understand that. And I do see that maybe there's that push and the pull coming back. But what hasn't changed, even from when you and I met, was the culture on campus that's driven by fraternities. And it's a really small segment. And this statistic always blows my mind. It's just relating to the hookup culture, you know, that 15% of those who participate in the hookup culture enjoy it. And the rest of the people, do your math, my engineer husband.
85%.
Thank you. The 85% of the rest of the people participate because they believe that that's the norm and that they have to in order to have a social life on campus. And so they're not really interested in that kind of interaction, that hookup, that kind of meaningless sexual encounters or whatever it involves. The 15% that seem to enjoy it and push the hookup culture on campus tend to be the white males, usually good-looking, who are members of the Greek system. I mean,
privileged. That's
privileged. And that's not just a guess. I mean, that comes from a book, The Hookup Culture, written by Dr. Wade, Laura Wade, I think is her name. She found that that was a statistic. And so even within the fraternity system, it's a small segment. It's 15% who are the ones who are pushing this hypermasculinity, this kind of rogue behavior, the bad boy behavior. And then the rest of them, the 85% of them who have joined because they want to have close relationships, they want to do good in the community, kind of get sucked into following along. And so I wonder if we don't need to absolutely rethink the Greek system, the fraternity system, that in some ways dismantle it as it stands and reformulate it in another way that's healthier and representative of the world that we're actually growing into, because this is an archaic system that takes these young men, and I'm going back to my dream of our nephew, and, you know, they take these young men at 18 years old who come into college wide-eyed, full of, I don't know, energy, full of hope and belief in the future, right? They're kind of a little easily malleable to situations because they want to belong to something. They want to feel like they're connected to the group. They come into these organizations. And again, preface it by saying, I've never gone through a Greek hazing or a pledge, so I can only go by what I've read in Rolling Stone's expose about the death on the campus in Ohio. But from what I'm gathering, they take these young men and they break them down. They completely break their spirit through the hazing and the pledging and, you know, kind of reform them into being part of this brotherhood. And I think that shifts them so fundamentally that as they, once they've pledged into this group, they in turn carry those values on to the people coming up behind him. And it's pushed by the national organization of alumni who also went through the same pledging or hazing or steps into brotherhood. And they want to see their memories of the good old days in the fraternity carry on. And so they want to make sure that these fraternities carry it on. But it's a dying aspect of the masculine culture, that it's not really what young men, I believe,
but it may still exist in the Greek system, because that's the expectation, that's a tradition, and maybe it's not really dying in the Greek system.
It's not, but think of what it pushes again, because if 15% of the population can push the entire, it's not just the Greek culture, 15% of the population pushes the behavior of the entire campus. Mm-hmm. And so this 15% influences our entire culture moving out into the captains of industry.
So there's still a popular culture kind of expectation. There was just a movie, what was the movie with about people have moved in next door to a fraternity or
family.
Oh, yeah. You know, and then Animal House, and mm-hmm. and so they're
kind of glorified.
And so when you're, you know, 12, 13, 15 years old, that's what you see the Greeks. That sounds fun. I'll do that.
Yeah.
You know, they're partying in high school, so there's some people, that's probably an expectation of college life.
And so, you know, what about for you, Tyler, like this idea of learning what is expected of a man as you're coming of age? I mean, was there a time in your life where you felt this pressure to let go of the feelings, emotional part of you, and kind of step into this, no, now you're a man now?
I mean, yeah, I was definitely, I mean, I was a very sensitive little kid, and, you know, also growing up gay in West Texas, and then I countered it because I didn't want to get made fun of or beat up. I joined the football team. So I learned how to be a teenager from the locker room of a football team in West Texas. So.
Which is kind of like a fraternity, I would imagine, right? That there's hazings.
It is very much that.
Yeah.
Little less, hazing, definitely. Some getting made fun of, and you learn different ways that you want to fit in. And, you know, I definitely, nothing at all excuses any of the behavior of any of these guys, and they're completely wrong on all counts. I do understand the level of wanting to sort of, this idea of wanting to make, it is toxic masculinity. They want to be the most alpha one, the best one, the funniest one.
Right.
And then when that happens, things just go completely out of control. Do you know what I mean? And so.
And I'm glad you said that, because I do want to make sure I'm dancing this well today, that I don't want the show to sound like I am excusing what happened on any level. But the therapist in me, and the mother in me, and the sister in me, and the mother-in-law in me, and the aunt in me, like the part of me that loves all of the men in my life so much, wants to be able to step back and say, we can't broad stroke the entire world of men, because of the bad behavior, 15%, because that's what's happening on campus now, is this 15% is able to push the culture forward. And so how do we get that 85% to be able to rise up and say, no, this is the way we're moving forward, and then to somehow recapture that 15%? And because the therapist to me also believes that that 15% is hyper-masculine, because ultimately they're the ones that are the most sensitive and the most afraid of being called out and the most afraid of being recognized as being too soft.
I mean, I think there's definitely something to that. I just think that that's something that they probably would never admit.
No.
So to tell them that they're afraid, they're definitely going to shoot that down. So.
Absolutely. And then what happens, because remember the theme of the show was the musings on marriage, you see these young men take that hypermasculinity into their relationships, into their marriage. And, you know, for most men, their only real intimate relationship is with their spouse, because mm-hmm. the culture doesn't look nicely upon men with many, right, close ties, and you don't going to tell another guy your emotional feelings. So these guys have all these feelings. They pour it into this one relationship, and yet they don't have the skills to nurture that relationship in a loving way. And when that relationship ends in divorce or however it plays out, these men fall into these behaviors of, you know, alcoholism, aggressive behavior, anger. You know, it doesn't bode well. Like, not having an outlet for half of our feeling existence as human beings does not go well for men. And so it's almost tragic on more levels than we're even discussing.
I mean, I definitely understand. I tried to fit into that culture so much growing up, and then it didn't work well for me. And so I developed really strong relationships with women mm-hmm. growing up, and that lasted for a long time. And it honestly wasn't until my late 20s or 30s that I developed really amazing relationships with men, and a lot of them are gay men, because we have a really amazing community. But I definitely was sort of pushed out of that because I didn't fit the mold mm-hmm. where I grew up, and so I kind of went to the other side, and then have now found my way back, and now get along with everybody.
This is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And the topic today is a little broad. I'm musing on marriage and the impact of our hypermasculinity that's being taught to young men at a young age, how it impacts our most intimate relationships. And I'd also like to talk about what's happening on campus. What happens to these beautiful young boys as they move into the adult world, or the man's world, that breaks them and forces them to let go of these parts of themselves that would actually make their lives more deep and rich and meaningful. Our number is 805-781-3875. We're going to take a quick break and come back and open the phone lines to take your calls.
Took one look at you, and it was plain to see you were my destiny.
With arms open wide, I threw away my pride. I'll sacrifice for you, dedicate my life to you. I'll go where you lead.
Come on, baby.
Always there in time of need.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and I'm joined today in the studio by my husband, Chris Barrett, somewhat reluctant participant, but because I wanted to talk about masculinity and men, I felt like I needed to have my other half to balance out the conversation a bit. So let's talk about a little bit of the relational piece, okay?
Okay.
All right. So one of the concerns that we have in long-term relationships in marriage is, how do we retain and maintain that intimacy, that connection, that love, you know, between two people? And part of that intimacy is dependent upon kind of each person being willing to disclose or open up or be vulnerable to the other person. And I wonder if they're that pressure, like when you're first in love, when we were young in those first 20 something years, and you're kind of feeling really excited about your relationship, it's kind of easy to maintain that intimacy. But I wonder, do you ever feel a pressure? I mean, Do men feel the pressure now that you're speaking for all men that you need to be the man of the family, that, you know, now that we have children and you have a mortgage and you have a job, is there part of you that feels like you have to be more stoic and then you kind of lose touch with the gentler side?
I don't feel like I have to be, but that sometimes is an impulse based on my childhood and my father's, you know, hit the way he did the job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I have to be that way. I mean, I was pretty open and honest with our daughters.
Oh, absolutely. But I wonder from our perspective and looking at the men that I know and even the young men, you know, my daughter's cohort of young men who are in their 30s now, that you see kind of this movement from this lighthearted, easygoing, fun guys, connected, want to stay up all night and talk, but then they kind of fall into this role of expectations. You need to be the breadwinner. Now you need to support a family and you got to pay that mortgage. And I wonder if just the whole foundation of our culture causes men to have to become more stoic.
You know, I don't know if it's my nature or is a cultural thing, but I did kind of not want to talk about the pressures at times. And when something bad's going on at work, I want to bring it home and burden you. You already, you know, had a full day with all the challenges you had, you know, raising kids at home full time.
And you're married to a therapist. So I wonder for all the men who aren't, how often they maybe stuff those feelings and feel like they can't open up. But it's like the minute you shut the door on sharing all of those feelings, maybe negative feelings or uncomfortable feelings, it's hard to keep the door open for the positive ones as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. It's your turn, Ethan. What do you think?
Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for having me on.
I'm glad you called in. What's on your mind today?
So kind of going back to the idea of your question of what we can do for young men in this culture to help them kind of prep for the college life of this 15% pushing on this 85% to be this masculine, breadwinning individual, correct?
Exactly.
So in my life, I'm a 19-year-old freshman college student, and I feel comfortable in my sexuality and all of these things. And I think it might have been attributed to the kind of activities I had during high school, and specifically, they were co-ed. A lot of what I've seen is perhaps the separation of the sexes, you know, football being very masculine, and then cheerleading being very feminine.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact they can interchange very easily. I know of men and boys who have been on cheerleading teams.
Absolutely.
So perhaps having this idea of co-edness, maybe in the Greek life, in the Greek establishment, might help the situation that we're currently in. I don't know, just a suggestion.
No, I like that, because almost like humanizing women as your peers and not this mysterious force out in the world that you somehow need to conquer or sway, right? That it makes women just people.
Absolutely, yeah. I think you totally hit it on the head there, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that you're working side by side with a woman. For me, I was on a swim team. I was in theater in high school, and a lot of the time, women were, if not the same level, but had more responsibility than I had as a man. So I had to be able to work with them and be able to figure out our strengths and weaknesses and how to overcome certain challenges, whether it be a swim meet or a show that's coming up. Right.
Right.
So having that, maybe that, not an expectation, but a understanding that that's the world that people are going to walk into, and you can't, a way to look at it is the world is changing.
Yes.
And the fact of the matter is that you can't force it in the opposite or in another direction or direction that's very man-oriented, right?
Yes.
So I think that has a lot to do with it, is having this idea that women are equal and can be even more powerful in certain contexts.
So in part, Ethan, it's you know, lifting the status of women and the feminine in our culture, but also my concern is that I don't want to throw out men and masculinity, because I think there is a really healthy place for that. I mean, that's what brings us together, is that draw, you know, that interest, that attraction to the other, those differences. And so part of me also wants to find a way to lift the masculine in a healthy way, so young men don't feel like they have to reject whole parts of their being just to fit in. Like, did you ever feel that pressure, you know, that you needed to conform in some way, as Tyler was talking about, to fit into the culture?
Yes, there was a time in high school where I felt like I had to be, you know, the hookup kind of guy. I had to be funny. I had to, you know, have sexual interactions with women in order to fit in or brag about those kinds of interactions. So, absolutely. And I think it's a shame that masculinity equates to dominating women. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe a redefinition of masculinity is perhaps the route to do it. And that it's not the opposite of feminism.
No.
But in fact, they can coincide together.
Right, the partnership.
I think perhaps that's a way of integrating or maybe promoting a positive way of using masculinity in the culture.
And I think it's going to be, you know, I talk a lot in my class about the fourth wave of feminism, and I really believe that the fourth wave will be pushed by men who want to become connected to their own feminine energies, to their nurturing feelings, to be able to emote and cry and be open and not have to be stoic and stuff feelings down. You know, because as I said right before you went on the air, that I notice in a lot of men and men that I live with and have grown up with, that they take on this role of provider and leader of the family and paying of mortgage. And in some ways, they stop sharing themselves because they don't want to seem like they don't have it under control or they don't have it handled. And I think that's to their detriment. And to carry it back to the fraternity, when we're teaching these young men that the more hyper-masculine and aggressive you are and domineering, that that's somehow going to be a benefit. But I think these men ultimately suffer greater because they completely lose themselves in it.
Absolutely right. It's almost crippling to their own masculinity.
Yes.
It doesn't open up a full their full capability of being able to express themselves.
Yes.
And if I may, can Tyler hear me?
No. Yes, he can now.
Okay. All right.
Yes, I can. I was making a phone call.
I was just wondering. So you are homosexual, correct?
Yes.
If I may.
Very.
Okay, all right. And just a question. Do you tell your friends that may or may not be gay, but do you tell them that you love them, that you're there for them? Maybe in a certain circumstance that women say, oh, she's my girlfriend, she's, you know, I love her, she's my sister, that kind of thing. Do you ever do that to your guy friends?
I absolutely do, and especially, you know, I'm in my 30s now, so I've had some of these relationships for a long time, and so, you know, maybe when I was younger, I didn't have quite all of those love feelings, didn't understand them. But now that I'm older and I've known people for a long time, I share a lot of different loves with a lot of different people. And those go from friends to family to people that I'm in relationships to even ex-lovers. It's a different kind of relationship across the board. And they say love a lot, actually, to people that I care about. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. And I think that's awesome, because I'm a straight male. I'm heterosexual. I like girls, women.
Got it.
And I tell my friends that I love them, my guy friends that I love them. And I think perhaps showing that it's okay to have these emotions towards men, just like you guys are talking, is super beneficial to the masculinity, being able to build yourself as an individual, and also to build relationships with just humans in general, right?
I think absolutely, Ethan. You know, and I would I don't have the reference right now, but I would suggest you to do a little Googling around on the internet. I have seen a couple of articles about this floating around by some pretty big publications right now about how we train men to not say this to other men. So I would do a little research about that. And there's some pretty great articles out there. I've seen them on Facebook recently.
Ethan.
Awesome. Thank you, Tyler. Appreciate it. Yeah.
Ethan, I love you. And thank you for taking the time to call, because you made my day.
I love you too, Ethan.
Oh, you know what? I really appreciate you guys having me on the air. Public news is really the only news that I trust and I listen to. And you guys just keep doing wonderful things that you're doing.
Thank you, Ethan. Call anytime. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm here in the studio with my husband, Chris, today. Tyler's here. We're kind of trying to broach this very large subject of masculinity, men, marriage, relationships. And so Ethan said such an interesting thing, honey, that – you know, about, do you say you love, I love you to your friends? And that's been kind of something that's, you've grown into. I mean, I know you easily say, I love you to my dad and to my brother and to our son-in-law, but I think with your friends even, has that changed? Because I don't think your high school friends, you would have said that when you were 20, but now at 50.
And guys didn't hug when I was 20.
Right. And so do you feel like you've transformed yourself, or do you think it's a change with the culture?
Yeah, I think I've changed, and it came along with the cultural progress.
The cultural acceptance.
Evolution.
And I think that really is at the heart of it. Love is the essence. If we can freely open our hearts and love other people without feeling fear of being judged or rejected, that is the beginning of the healing. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of the conversation. Livia, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Two things. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I forgot your husband's name.
Chris.
But did he, when we were talking about the students at Cal Poly, when you talked about students at Cal Poly, did he say the blacks?
No. We were talking about an incident where one of the students dressed in blackface, and that was what caused...
Okay. Well, because one of the things is... The phrases blacks and whites, if you have an Italian friend, you say he's Italian-American, but we tend to just a blanket blacks, whites, which leaves that three-dimensional aspect of each individual out.
I appreciate that.
So anyway, I think that's one of the sensitivities that people should be aware of. The other thing is, I have a book called Self-Compassion by Kristen Neff. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting things she does is compare self-compassion with self-esteem and narcissism. And the thing is, with self-esteem, you have to be better than someone in some way to like yourself. Mm-hmm. And self-compassion, everybody needs self-compassion, and they need to care about each other. And the book processes how you can do that, male and female. And I think that adds, if you're compassionate to yourself, if you accept your feelings. But one of the things, the cultural things, is crying. You know, tears have a chemical that heal. And depending on the culture, Italians cry and probably live longer and show emotion. And things that people say when they're younger, for example, my husband's father had the Last Supper that he crocheted. And he was pointing out to my son, a man did that. Mm. A man can crochet.
And I think that's a beautiful message for a father to share with his son, because that's kind of the theme of today, is how do we overcome kind of this very narrow definition of what it is to be a man in our society, and how do we overcome the fact that it's a very small part of our society that is pushing this kind of hyper-toxic masculinity? How do we broaden our understanding of what it is to be a man and engage all of the stories, like a father telling his son, hey, you can crochet this, or, you know, teaching a young man to say, I love you, or allowing that 14-year-old who has kind of developed that adolescent veneer of I'm too cool and I don't have feelings, how do we keep them engaged in our culture and in society in a ways that makes them feel supported and loved? And I love that you bring in the aspect of compassion, Livia, because when we have compassion for ourselves, when we have compassion for others, we open, that keeps us open and available for connection and intimacy. And I think that is at the heart of how do we continue to model and teach compassion in a way that keeps people open and available. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of our conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is Public Radio KCBX. And is it Zimi?
Yes.
You're on the air. What's on your mind today?
I just wanted to mention that in our society we have this idea that masculine is a male trait, and feminism is a female trait, and I think that that's also part of where the problem is when you're talking about our society and our culture and how we view men and women and what's appropriate. I just think that it would be better if we didn't have such rigid ideas of you know, men should be masculine and women should be feminine.
Well, and that's why I kind of keep trying to broach the conversation by saying, how do we keep that feminine aspect of a young man's life alive? Because although, you know, that sounds narrow in the roles, masculinity and femininity, men and women, we all contain the essence of the masculine and the feminine in us. All of us have the capacity. Right. And so the whole kind of thesis at the beginning of the show is, how do we help men retain that feminine that seems to be stripped from them, starting in adolescence? And then, as I talked about on the campus culture and the fraternities, through the pledging or the hazing or, you know, becoming part of this group think, they lose more of their connection to that feminine side of themselves. And so the whole work is, how do we, because we spent a lot of time helping women over the last 40 years, 50 years since the second wave of feminism to gain their masculinity, right? To tap into their masculine mm-hmm. energy. But I think we need to do equally as much work to help young men feel comfortable expressing their feminine energy.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think I was just trying to point out that maybe even using the term masculine and feminine needs to be scrapped.
But then how do we talk about that then? Because
that's a good question. I don't have the answer. I think there's so much behind those words that sort of automatically trigger this idea of male versus female when having a conversation. So that might make it harder for certain people to be open to the idea of possessing what we would consider feminine qualities.
And I think because language has so much power, my concern in that is almost that they both have negative connotations. Like, well, I don't want to be associated with the feminine energy because that would mean I'm being like a woman. And so unless we can take the power of those words, I hate the idea of scrapping them completely, because that's giving away something that's really beautiful. Because ultimately, at the beginning of the show, my goal was to have that musings on marriage and what is it that keeps a marriage alive and rejuvenated for 50 years. You know, when we look at the spring and young love, we think that's something that dies out. But what keeps, you know, what starts that marriage is that energy between two people that excites them about each other. You know, that masculine and feminine coming together, that energy that feels overwhelming. You know, that romantic love that has to be driven by something. And so I'd hate to scrap all of those different energies and have kind of this asexual experience. I want to embrace those differences, and I want to engage in those things that I love about men or love about masculinity, because it's what keeps me excited about my relationship and about life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why I grapple with it, because I don't know what, I don't want to scrap it or throw it out and have nothing to replace it, because then what do we do with the essence of our life, which is those loving, intimate relationships that sustain us?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't know if there are terms that can be replaced, yeah, I don't have the answer for that.
I don't either. But I think unless we're having the conversations, we don't even offer it up. And now how we've grown in our understanding of pronouns and people's, how they identify, you know, I can imagine that our language will also continue to morph and grow and change. I just hope that in our society, we will continue to honor those things that bring us together, that make us excited to be together, as well as growing our definitions of what it is to come together in a union of any kind.
Right.
Thank you for calling, Jamie. I appreciate your perspective.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. My guest today is my husband, Chris Barrett. He's in the studio kind of, I put you in the hot seat, honey, about the whole masculinity piece and how things have changed or not changed over the course of your lifetime, and looking at the fraternity culture on campus, and what happens to, you know, young men getting pushed into the system that is considered, you know, the height of achievement is to be, you know, in a good house with, you know, high powered young men. And this promise carries out into the grander culture where now you're going to be the captains of industry and the presidents of universities or whatever that job is. It's almost like the stepping stone. But I worry so much about what's left behind or dropped along the way by these young men so that they can fit in. And do you, you know, working with all the young men that you do, do you see it shifting? Or do you think we still have a lot of work to do?
Well, the young people I hire, you know, the college graduates I hire quite often are not necessarily the most socially active.
That's true, too.
They may have shown leadership skills on work project or school projects as project engineers and competitive, you know, like a high mileage car or a light, you know, human powered vehicle or design projects. So they're not necessarily the social movers and shakers.
And so maybe it is, you know, there is this very small segment of our population. And maybe that, again, is why I want to focus on this 15%. We're not talking about a huge cultural shift. We're talking about somehow getting involved in this 15% of our population that feels like they must enter into this masculine, hyper-masculine world in order to succeed. And if we could shift their understandings of what it is to be a man in society, that would improve the whole campus experience. Just a thought. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can find me on my Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, or send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. As always, I really appreciate you participating in these conversations, being a part of the community, supporting public radio, and I look forward to our conversation next Tuesday at 2. Thank you for supporting the show and for supporting public radio. Radio KCBX.
Wanna pack your bag, something small. Take what you need and we disappear. Without a trace, we'll be gone, gone. The moon and the stars will follow the calm. And then when we get to the ocean, gonna take a boat to the end of the world, all the way to the end of the world. Oh, and when the kids are old enough, we're gonna teach them to to the ground, not falling but rising like rolling around. Eyes closed above the rooftops, eyes closed, we're gonna spin through the stars. Our arms wide as the sky, we're gonna ride the blue all the way to the end of the world. End of the world. Oh, when the kids are old enough, we're gonna teach them to fly. You and me too. Together, yes, yes.
so small.